it a bunch of skinhead morons, as often depicted by the media. Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
The U.S. military says a senior member of al-Qaeda in Iraq has died. Officials identify the insurgent as Haji Hamadi, who was one of two militants killed during a U.S.-led raid last week. The Pakistani government has summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest what it believes was a U.S. missile strike deep in Pakistani territory yesterday. Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani argues that Washington's policies are undermining Pakistan's own efforts to stem Islamist extremism. But the Bush administration argues Gilani's government isn't doing enough. The U.S. has stepped up missile attacks against Pakistan-based militants since August. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from The Sea Boat, featuring a southern style of cooking walleye and catfish, chicken, shrimp, sandwiches, and more, available for dine-in and carry-out. The Sea Boat, 402 West Kirby, across from Jerry's IGA in Champaign. Catering services available at 355-9933. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting Haydn's Mass in Time of War at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, November 22nd at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Featured will be tenor Gerald Sienna, bass baritone Ronald Headland, and the Bach Chorus. Ticket information is at 355-9077 or prairieensemble.org.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. When Franklin Roosevelt became the Democratic nominee for president, he promised two Americans a New Deal. He said he promised there would be a new deal for the American people. And in that speech, and this was when he actually was accepting the nomination, he talked about doing a number of things that would put money into public works, that would improve conditions for working Americans, that would address problems with the securities market. And then when he became president, he worked with Congress to do those things and, in fact, did a lot more, put into place many of the programs that we're familiar with now, including Social Security and insurance to help people who are unemployed, people who are disabled. There was support for unionization. There was deposit insurance. All of these things that we have come to associate with the New Deal. We thought that as now we are in a serious financial crisis and the people are making comparisons or perhaps are interested in making some comparisons between where we are now and where we were then, that we would talk a little bit about the Depression and the New Deal. And we have as our guest this morning, Eric Rauchway. He's a professor of history at the University of California at Davis, and he is the author of a book. It's titled The Great Depression and the New Deal, A Very Short Introduction. This book is published by the Oxford University Press and is part of a series of books, quite a long list of books in this short introduction series that have to do with history, American history, world history, history of science, archaeology, philosophy. There are books about particular individuals, and it is indeed a good short treatment of many different subjects. So if you're interested in the Depression and the New Deal or some of these other things, you could seek out the books. As we talk this morning with our guest, Eric Rauchway, we certainly welcome your questions and comments, as always. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, people who are listening, they can call in. You can call in with your questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-945. So, 9455. So, either way, if you're here locally, 333-9455. If it would be a long distance call, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Rauchway, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, I'm interested here in thinking about how, as you explain in the book, when Franklin Roosevelt was talking about a new deal for the American people, that there actually is a difference between what he said, what he talked about, a New Deal. That doesn't necessarily mean the New Deal, you know, capital N, capital D. Those are kind of two different things. When, in as much as we know this, when he was talking about a New Deal for the American people, did indeed he what was his vision, and was it as big and as encompassing as the New Deal eventually became?
I think it's important to make that distinction. Thanks. I think the New Deal, as we know it, sort of looking at it in retrospect, encompasses a lot of institutions that Roosevelt had no idea or at least didn't propose as necessary when he ran for office in 1932 or when he first took office in 1933. And they were institutions that came about as a result of the conditions of the Depression, as a result of the political responses to the New Deal, both within Congress and at the polls, and as a result of the opposition of the Supreme Court to some of the New Deal's initial efforts. So the New Dealers had to do some new things to get around the Supreme Court's opposition, and thus giving us the institutions that actually lasted. When you mentioned Roosevelt's acceptance of the nomination, it's kind of a smorgasbord of offerings. Mm-hmm. We're going to try as best we can to solve all of these problems. And in that speech, he harked back to the Democratic Party's tradition of progressivism under Woodrow Wilson, which meant that he was alluding to, you know, some unfinished agenda items. And many of those things became part of the New Deal over time and didn't necessarily have anything to do with solving the immediate crisis. Many other things that you also mentioned that became part of the New Deal and that really are the hallmarks of the New Deal, the lasting bits of it, like Social Security Act, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Federal Reserve System as we know it now today, were also not really responses to the immediate crisis, but were efforts to try to prevent future crises. So all of those things sort of play into how we view the New Deal in retrospect. Looking forward from 1932 or 33, you might have no idea that that was what you were going to end up with.
Yeah. So it evolved, and it was, as you make the point, this was something of a collaborative effort. It certainly did involve leadership from the White House and from the Roosevelt administration, but it also very much involved Congress, and then it also involved the Supreme Court. So in a sense that all of the branches of government were involved in putting this thing together and what it became over time.
Yeah, not only was there collaboration, I mean, there was a great deal of conflict as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the New Deal's most successful and lasting measures were actually things that Roosevelt himself was not very keen on originally, but bubbled up from constituents through their congressional representatives and sort of were things that they insisted upon. I mean, some very important examples are things like, again, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Also, the Wagner Act, which is the New Deal's hallmark union legislation, came from Senator Robert Wagner of New York and was not particularly beloved of Roosevelt either. So it doesn't do to kind of attribute too much of the New Deal to Franklin Roosevelt. It's a much broader phenomenon.
Hmm. It's obviously here we're talking about things that one could write very long books on, and long books have been written. But if we just stay for a moment, go back for a moment to the Depression, this is something that if you ask people, well, when did the Depression start? I think most people would identify the stock market crash that came in late October 1929 as the starting point. They'd say, well, the Depression started in 1929. And I think also another of the points that you make in the book in trying to understand what was going on at this time and then to move to talk about the government response, that you seem to be saying, well, no, actually, the Depression didn't really start in 1929. It started maybe almost 10 years before that.
Yeah, I think that the stock market crash is best understood as a very sharp blow to a relatively fragile system. And if you want to really understand why it was so important, you have to think about the nature of that system, which, as you say, was really sort of designed somewhat willy-nilly in 1919. I mean, the key thing to think about is that after World War One, the world really changed sort of economically almost overnight. Before the war, Great Britain had been at the center of the financial and economic world, had been the world's great lender, had been the world's great military power, had been the center of the world's financial system. After World War One, that role fell to the United States, Britain having been so devastated during the war. And the United States went, you know, over the course of the war from being the world's great debtor to being the world's great creditor. And it was eminently unsuited to play that role simply from lack of experience, if nothing else. John Maynard Keynes is always an excellent guide to anything economic, but especially those things that he observed firsthand. And if you look at Keynes's response to the Treaty of Versailles, one of the things he says that turns out to be very prescient is, there is no, and I'm paraphrasing, but there is nothing in the treaty either to reconstruct Europe or to to readjust the systems of the old world and the new. And if we think about it, that in our long historical retrospect, what Keynes, in effect, is saying is, if you don't want to have a depression, and he uses that word in 1919, that there will be a depression, if you don't want to have a depression, what you would need is something like the Marshall Plan. What you would need is something like the Bretton Woods institutions, like the International Monetary Fund, that came about after World War II, after we learned some hard lessons. And there was nothing like that. And so as a consequence, the international economy was relatively ill-managed or unmanaged through the 1920s. A tremendous amount of money owing to the United States. Very little sort of productive investment over the decade. And when the United States was unable any longer to lend that money, the countries that depended on U.S. borrowing plunged into depression really in 1928, beginning to pull the United States along with them. At the same time as this is happening in the world, within the United States, you have a whole new kind of regime of borrowing, this time much more familiar, I think, to us. I mean, this is the decade in which Americans learn to buy consumer goods with money that they don't have, using credit that's been extended them by companies trying to get them to buy those goods. So this is the decade in which you see doubling of household debt. You see the invention of sort of planned obsolescence in the auto industry to try to get people to buy cars more frequently. You see the creation of GMAC, the financing corporation, which is, of course, helps people buy things on time. And you see a tremendous increase of debt-fueled borrowing. So what happens with the stock market crash is you have a blow to this system, and all of a sudden you have a tremendous increase of uncertainty. People don't know what's going to happen next, and people stop being willing to take out that kind of debt to buy things that they probably didn't, you know, critically need in the immediate future. But when they make that decision and consumer purchasing plunges in the months after the stock market crash, you begin to have Americans going out of jobs because they've depended on the continuing of that debt-fueled purchasing. This may sound somewhat grimly familiar to people who have been watching the headlines over the last month or so.
We have a caller here, and I want to get back to some of these points, but
sure.
rather, I don't want to make that person continue to wait. Very quickly, the guest for this part of Focus 580 is Eric Rauchway. He's professor of history at the University of California at Davis, and he is the author of the book, The Great Depression and the New Deal, A Very Short Introduction. It's published by the Oxford University Press. We have a caller here in Champaign on line one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks yes.
for taking my call.
Yeah.
I appreciate you making the connection with the current situation because that's where I'm going with my question. Some of the economists that I respect writing about the current situation are calling for a new deal, people like Paul Krugman or Dean Baker. But on the other side, and they're calling for deficit spending for infrastructure as a way to sort of jumpstart the economy. But I read on the other side people saying that that type of deficit spending is unsustainable and will only increase the country's debt in a way that will ultimately worsen the situation. So I'm wondering if you can put those arguments in perspective with what went on in the New Deal in the 1930s and the deficit spending that was undertaken back then.
Sure. The first thing to think about is, you know, when Krugman and Baker make those arguments, they're actually going beyond where the Roosevelt administration went until relatively late in the New Deal. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was very nervous about deficit spending, and that's one of the reasons usually cited for why the New Deal didn't do as much good as it could have done in its earlier years in terms of recovery. Partly this is only fair. We have to mention that Keynes didn't publish the general theory in which he sort of laid out the technical arguments supporting deficit spending until 1936, when you're well into the middle of the New Deal there. And Roosevelt's administration first tries out Keynes' prescriptions in 1938. It's generally said with some good effect, although that effect is massively increased when they begin war preparedness spending and running a deficit that's much greater. People are suddenly much less nervous about deficit spending when it's in the name of military defense. Thinking about the current situation, Krugman's argument, and to a lesser extent I think Baker's, are sort of written from the perspective of we understand what the Roosevelt administration learned relatively late, which is that if you want to spur a recovery from a potentially disastrous situation like the one that we have now and the one that the country endured in the 30s, you have to spend a tremendous amount relatively swiftly on deficit, and that's the only way you're going to see Keynesian principles take effect. The argument that we can't afford past 8 years, again, for military reasons, and nobody seems to have batted an eyelash about that. That argument seems almost to take the lessons of the New Deal in reverse. I mean, the story then seemed to be, well, we learned that what we really needed to do was to spend a tremendous amount on deficit, and only the war gave us the political will to do that. So the lesson of that story is we should have been willing to do it without a war. And that should probably be the lesson I think that Paul Krugman and Dean Baker would want you to take away now. They'll probably also go on to point out that sort of current measurements, our deficit or debt in relation to the size of the total economy, is not nearly like the biggest it's been. So there's probably some room to go in that area.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You were talking a little bit earlier about the things that precipitated the Depression, the fact that it seemed that at all levels of society there was people were heavily leveraged, and that when things started to contract, then understandably consumers who were nervous, or maybe it was because they just didn't have the money, they pulled back on their spending. Well, as you say, that looks like where we are right now, when I think some people would argue that the big problem was that we were very heavily leveraged all the way up from the government to big corporations, to individual households. People had borrowed a lot of money, and that so now we have problems paying that back. And then also we have people saying, well, I'm nervous. I'm not really sure what the future is going to hold here, so I'm not going to go out. And even if I could get a loan, I'm not going to buy a new car. We're not going to buy a new refrigerator. We're not going to charge a bunch of stuff on our credit cards. So I suppose the question is, well, That makes the place we are now look like the place we were then, but is it in a sense the same place, or are there significant differences between now and then?
Well, I think the answer is both. I mean, it is very similar. There are significant differences as well, and we should probably take both things into account. First of all, I don't think it does to be too censorious, either when reviewing the 20s or reviewing the past 10 years, about people's borrowing behavior. I mean, there's no inherent reason that kind of debt-driven purchasing is unstable, you know, provided certain other things don't happen, right? Mm. And the problem is that if you keep this kind of thing up for too long, those other things eventually always happen. I mean, theoretically, the borrowing in the 20s was sustainable and might have led to a recovery in the world economy had there not been significant shocks to the system. Unfortunately, there were, and terrific disasters ensued. I mean, what's the lesson you take away from that? The lesson that Keynes was proposing in 1919, the lesson that we were supposed to have learned from the New Deal, is that you prevent, by a sort of as light as possible government regulation, this kind of borrowing from getting out of hand before the bubble bursts. That's a lesson that we seem to have unlearned by failing to regulate or deregulating certain aspects of securities and banking. The thing that you're asking about similarities and differences, I mean, the similarities are the level of crisis in which we seem to find our banking system. And we've had numerous banks tremble and a few very large ones go under. And that poses a threat to all lending and borrowing right up and down the line. And during the New Deal, just as now, the federal government bought stock in banks to try to recapitalize them. And during the New Deal, as now, they then found that, this seems not to have been enough to get banks to start lending again. And so they had to do something else, which, again, is why we find a very large number of economists saying we need a fiscal stimulus to encourage the system to start working again. The principal differences between then and now are, I think, twofold. One of them is institutional. One of them, which is to say that things left over from the New Deal have so far worked pretty well at preventing things from getting as disastrous as they did in the early 30s. So, for example, we have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which brokered the failure and sale of Washington Mutual. In the late 20s, early 30s, when banks went under, people were just out of luck, and they had nothing to fall back on and no guarantee of their deposits. And that meant that people were that much more likely to actually yank their deposits when they saw banks trembling. And so this banking system was much more precarious in those days, and you had failure after failure after failure and sort of chain reactions. So far, we have not seen that, partly because we have an activist Federal Reserve Board and the FDIC preventing it from happening. So I guess that's a point to the New Deal. And the corollary of that, or probably the consequence of that, is because we haven't had those cascades of failures the way they did back in the 20s and early 30s, so far, fingers crossed and touching wood and so forth, we haven't seen the crisis spread in such a dire way to the household level. I mean, don't forget, by the time Roosevelt took office early in 33, the economy was just crippled. You had perhaps a quarter of workers officially unemployed. You had, you know, perhaps half of those remaining on well less than full-time employment. And the you know, whatever cliche you choose to use, basket case perhaps, is probably not adequate to describe the utter disaster that Roosevelt inherited. And, you know, God willing, and the cricks don't rise, we won't see that happen again.
I'm interested specifically, particularly for you to talk a little bit about Herbert Hoover, since it seems that people like to almost sort of place as bookends Hoover and Roosevelt, and talking about how Roosevelt did a great job and Hoover did a terrible job. And I wonder whether you think that may in fact be doing some injustice to Herbert Hoover and his administration and the attempts that were made to try to deal with this very serious financial challenge that the country faced.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you want a sort of a takeaway lesson, the truth is that Hoover did a terrible job. But, I mean, you can just look at the effects of what he did, and you can see that it wasn't very good. If you want to try to be fair to Herbert Hoover, you have to say, well, what could he have done that he didn't do? And when should he have done it, and would it have made a significant difference? So, for example, in October of 29, right after the crash, it's not at all clear that this is anything dramatically unlike any previous stock market crash or any previous economic downturn. I mean, the nation had experienced a reasonably severe recession in 1921 and thereabouts, and before in 1907. And people remembered back to the depression of the early 1890s, a lot of people who were alive in the 1930s and the late 20s. And it wasn't clear that this was going to be sort of something much more dire. So you have to kind of allow that Herbert Hoover, who then goes on the radio and or gives public addresses and does a kind of sort of happy talk number where he says, you know, things are fine, all people have to do is have more confidence and everything will go back to normal. You have to spot him one or two of those addresses. Although as time goes on, that becomes less and less forgivable, and certainly Americans at the time did not forgive him continuing to do that when it became clear that this was nothing like any previous situation. The second thing is that, you know, some of the things that Herbert Hoover did do were, on the face of them, not terrible ideas, but didn't work very well. So, for example, he tried to get businessmen to pledge not to lower wages, which was supposed to keep consumer spending up. Maybe on the face of it, not a terrible idea, but in fact, kind of a terrible idea in practice. I mean, it didn't work. So it wasn't effective. He couldn't reach enough businessmen to keep wages up. Second of all, businessmen, by keeping wages up, didn't therefore necessarily keep people employed because they simply cut hours or laid people off. So you ended up simply with fewer workers at higher wages, and that didn't do a great deal of good to forestall any crises. The things that people generally... and then, of course, Hoover signed into law the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which is usually... probably rightly condemned for cutting off nations around the world one from another and making it that much harder for each of them to pull out of the crisis in which they were in because it cut down on the volume of international trade. Hoover also restricted immigration, not to any great, with using some of his discretionary powers. He raised taxes, which we generally don't regard as a good idea during a downturn, at least not as a recovery measure. The things that he didn't do that he probably should have done, certainly by the time he got into 31 and 32, were he opposed resolutely any kind of federal aid to the unemployed, and he opposed right up until the time he left office in March of 1933, shutting the banks for a bank holiday, and he using the government's abilities to buy bank stock to recapitalize the banks, which were things that Roosevelt did almost immediately upon coming into office. So say that Herbert Hoover was dealt a bad hand. I mean, he didn't cause the recession or didn't cause the depression. He, you know, could be forgiven for not realizing the magnitude of crisis for some time after it occurred. But one's goodwill, certainly Americans' goodwill at the time, does begin to get thin after a while towards Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, you have to, and as you say, he was in office when the crash came. He was in office like 8 months or something like that, and so a lot of what was in place there was in place when he became the president. So again, I guess we'll have to lay some more of that at the door of Calvin Coolidge, who was the president before. But at the same time, you'd have to say, you know, he could have done some of those things that Roosevelt did right away. So I guess you'd have to say both of those things. Yeah, he did get a bad hand, but he didn't play it very well when he had the chance to play.
I think that's right, yeah.
Let's talk with somebody else here. Line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. You've pointed to the leveraging of debt as one of the factors in the 1920s, early 30s, and the present time as a factor in the economic conditions. I wonder about the disparity of income levels. It seems to me that there was from the late 1800s on into the 30s, a very increasing disparity of wealth, which seems paralleled again from, say, the 1980s to the present, with the very rich becoming much richer and the majority of the population income stagnating and real wealth actually declining.
Yes, that I think in broad outline that's true, that there was a tremendous increase in inequality in the late 19th century, mostly, as you say, focused on making very rich people, and that has been somewhat paralleled in the era since sort of, I guess, the early 70s in recent history. In terms of the relationship of that state of affairs to the Depression, in the 20s, I think you have to say a couple things. Of course, had sort of average incomes been higher and the price of goods being relatively lower, you probably would have had less buying on credit. I mean, one way to think about that is, you know, sort of the road not taken is the Ford Motor Company. I mean, the Ford Motor Company made Model Ts, and the Model T was a standard issue item. You know, you could have any color you wanted as long as it was black, as Henry Ford famously said. And they lowered the price of the Model T year on year through its existence, so it became cheaper and cheaper and more affordable. Ford himself believed in paying his employees relatively high wages and you know, giving them relatively good working conditions. And so the model there is you pay workers well, they buy cars that are cheap, and so they can live well on money that they get by working. The thing about the Ford model is that Ford has to stop making the Model T because GM comes along and says, you know, we can sell more cars if we make people buy cars that have, you know, fancy features and are different colors. And we can sell them on credit, and people will buy cars that they don't need with money they don't have, and we can make much more money that way. So the Ford model, I mean, we can say all kinds of unpleasant things about Ford, by the way, it bears mentioning, but in this case, we can sell relatively good things about Ford. The Ford model is the road not taken. That is not what the American economy ends up looking like in the 1920s. The other thing you can say about the disparity in incomes is it probably makes the economy quicker to fall apart when a crisis comes. I mean, if you have an era where you have no or relatively little unemployment insurance, which is characteristic of the late 1920s, when people go out of work, they exhaust their savings. By the way, when they exhaust their savings, that puts a lot of pressure on the weak banking system because they're drawing down deposits. People exhaust their savings, and they have very little cushion if they haven't been earning very much. So obviously, if people had been earning a higher wage, they would have had a bigger cushion. That probably all is true of the recent past as well, that with higher wages relative to the price of things, people probably would have taken on less credit. With higher wages, people might also have had higher savings. So those comparisons probably stand.
Thank you. Also, in the there seems to be a difference, I suppose. One of the factors leading to the depression, there had actually been a farm depression, rural depression,
right?
From from the very early 20s, I suppose, whenever the wheat price crashed. There had been relative prosperity during the First World War because of the demand for farm products. It seems to me that at present, the rural economy may be quite not very good, but there are so few farmers that the farmers actually have very little effect on purchasing.
Yeah, all of those things I think are right, and you know the course of the farm economy, going back to as far back as we're going in this discussion, is mostly determined by government policy. I mean, the boom during the war years is because of the war, because of the demise of you know, foreign competition, and you have the shutdown in trade. And you have a lot more acres brought under cultivation. You also have this is not really government policy. You have the tractor coming in, and so you have mechanization of farming. You have a lot of mules going out of work all of a sudden. And then when the war is over and something more like normal conditions resume, you have a lot of surplus acreage, or at least this is the conventional explanation. You also have a drop in demand because you have prohibition. So all of a sudden grain is less in demand for fermenting. That is a government policy. And so, yes, as you say, farmers are feeling the pinch, really, from the end of the 19-teens. And it's the first half of the 19-teens that they always hark back to, from the 20s right into the Depression, as the era that they want to see in terms of standards of living. And you're quite right that, of course, a much larger number of Americans are employed in farming in the 30s than are now. I mean, then it was as many as, I think, around 10 million. And the era, the Hoover administration is sort of the last era in American history when you do see Americans moving to the farm, because this is one of the effects of the crisis, is that people sort of out of work in cities go back to the countryside. It's sort of the last era when people have relatives on farms that they can go and depend on. And that long farming crisis fuels New Deal farm policy. That's one of the reasons you get the Agricultural Adjustment Administration in the early New Deal, which levies a tax on processing to, you know, pay subsidies to limit farm production, which is a policy that's in altered form still with us today. And as you say, it's led to a much smaller farm sector, subsidized to produce less than, you know, sort of given the endowment that we actually have, we probably could. I'm not sure it's right to say that the farm sector has a diminished, or maybe diminished, but not small, voice in our political process. I think that, I mean, I'm talking to you from the middle of farm country now, so I speak advisedly. But, you know, the institution of the Senate massively overrepresents large areas where very few people live, which tend to be farming areas, as against, of course, the House, which represents cities far more generally. And indeed, up through the 1920s going into the New Deal, even the House saw an overrepresentation of farming areas because somehow after the 1920 census, they neglected to reapportion the House of Representatives. So although you had a much more urban country, that was not reflected in the congressional election. So I'm not sure that farmers have an undersized voice in the nation's political affairs going back to World War One.
I wasn't thinking so much of their voice in the political affairs as I was their economic purchase. And, of course, they have a very large purchase of inputs to agriculture, but I was thinking of their purchase as families.
Acting as consumers.
Yes, consumers, yes.
Yeah,
may I ask one other question?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the center of controversy seems to be the automobile industry. And it seems to me at points that the opposition to bailing out the auto industry may be as much a desire to break unions as it is reluctance to bail out the industry. But what would be the effect of the auto industry actually collapsing?
I have to offer the standard caveat here that as a historian, I don't do the future. But, my willingness to speculate is going to be informed solely by facts, which is to say there are some millions of people employed in the auto industry to have it go out of work, have them go out of work relatively suddenly would be an economic catastrophe that would probably send us over the brink into something that looks a lot more like the early 1930s. So that's probably something that somehow we want to avoid, whether by bailout or by other means. I'm not sure about, I don't know about the motives of the people who are opposing a bailout, whether it's union-related, but it's certainly worth pointing out, again, sort of thinking in terms of the Depression. You didn't get an era of significant unionization in the United States until after the Wagner Act of 1935. You know, the slogan became, "The president wants you to join a union." It didn't really become true until collective bargaining was legally recognized in 1935. And, you know, remarkably, in the latter part of the 30s, there's a great increase in unionization, which, as I say, is remarkable because it's also an era of high unemployment. So, you know, if you're a troublemaker, your employer could presumably hire anybody else to replace you. And yet, here, presumably, again, because of government policy, you have an increase in unionization because unions are protected. So for the first real time in American history, and that protection is somewhat damaged by the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, which takes away a lot of the Wagner Act's provisions. But still, unionization law is pretty strong after 1947. And certainly in comparison to what it was early in American history. And yet we've had a decline in unionization since probably sometime in the middle 50s. And as you say, you know, the automobile industry is certainly one of the few remaining high-profile manufacturing areas where unions are really, really important. Whether that affects people's attitudes towards rescuing that industry or not, I don't know. But putting that in the context of the history going back to 35, I mean, it's sort of, again, it's one of the few remaining legacies of that aspect of Depression-era policy.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Rauchway. He's professor of history at the University of California, Davis. And we're talking about the Depression and the New Deal, and that those two things are the subject of his book, The Great Depression and the New Deal, A Very Short Introduction. It's published by the Oxford University Press, and it's part of a series of books, short introduction books, on a wide range of subjects that they have. So you might want to take a look at that. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have about 15 minutes left, and maybe just again to talk a little bit more about the New Deal. You say one way that you have of structuring your conversation here is basically to divide things into three groups, either those things that actually helped reverse the Depression, those things that didn't, and those things that perhaps didn't have anything to do with what was going on right at that moment in helping turn things around, but were something that would prevent, like deposit insurance, for example, that would be one of those things that would go in the third category that would prevent such a thing happening again. Just wonder if you could kind of quickly talk about some things that fall into each of those three categories.
Sure. Well, I mean, in terms of the most successful policies in reversing the downturn and putting the country on the road to the recovery, I think you really have to point to the banking and currency legislation. We've touched on some of that already. The bank holiday, stabilizing the banks, recapitalizing the banks. Roosevelt's devaluing the dollar was probably one of the most successful things in this respect because it drew a lot of foreign investment into the country. So you had a lot of money coming into American banks after 1933. Taking the dollar off gold and reducing its value relative to gold. That all worked relatively well, and I think that those are pretty uncontroversial amongst sort of serious students of the 30s in terms of their success. In terms of successful policies and sort of reversing the downturn, I think you have to point to relief. The employment by the federal government of Americans to prevent them, in some cases, literally from starving to death. Roosevelt himself was relatively reluctant to do this, and so you have a kind of a halting relief program, and there are a series of agencies with lots of initials that people probably remember or fail to remember from eighth grade. But it's not until 1935 with the Works Progress Administration that they really go into this business in a big scale, and they have as many as 3.5 million or so people working for the federal government in some relief capacity or other in the depths of the Depression. And this is, tremendously useful, first of all, and as I say, putting money in people's pockets, who then spend the money and saving them from, you know, being unproductive because they're actually doing work. In many of the WPA projects, I mean, we think probably today of the theater projects and the mural projects and some of the artistic things, which are some of the things that you usually get shown if you do a kind of tour of remaining New Deal legacies. But we should probably also think of the enormous number of bridges and highways and seaports and airports and schools that the WAPA built that provided the country with its infrastructure for really the better part of the remaining 20th century, quite successfully and quite economically productively over the long haul. Things that didn't work, we've already touched a little bit on the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. I mean, that's kind of a piece with a similar industrial policy. The National Recovery Administration, both of them tried to kind of raise prices and raise wages at the same time. That's just not going to be a very good recipe for recovery, because as your wages go up, if your prices are also going up, your purchasing power doesn't actually increase. On top of that, they're kind of centralized planning agencies, and that's just, as a practical matter, very difficult to implement, and they do fail to implement them in any significant way. And, of course, very politically unpopular in terms of people being told sort of what to do. And both of those are, declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1935, and B, kind of repurposed, and they're sort of better features reenacted under different rubrics. So getting onto the third category, the things that lasted and kind of try to prevent future crises from being so bad. The agricultural policy was rewritten under the rubric of soil conservation and making better use of resources. Union policies were rewritten not as sort of central planning support for labor and the government saying what wages and working conditions could be, but making sure that unions could organize and negotiate for themselves and get concession out of management without the government really doing any kind of severe intervention. Also, policies that went into place to develop regions of the country that had been relatively underdeveloped helped to, you know, give those parts of the country the ability to negotiate for themselves in the nation's political arena. So you get the Tennessee Valley Authority, which brought electricity to the South, and the Rural Electrification Administration, which extended that program to the West as well, bringing modernity to these parts of the country that hadn't had it, and enabling them to set on the road towards higher wage economies and the ability to fend for themselves, and rather than to sort of be virtual wards of the state or the Democratic Party, depending on how you look at it. And also legislation that focused on giving individuals an important amount of power. You mentioned the Social Security Act. I mean, this is really, in many ways, the cornerstone of the New Deal state that emerges. It not only provides old age pensions, which is what we usually think about when we think about Social Security, which are contributory rather than being sort of redistributive, which is to say we pay into them ourselves and allegedly have our sort of little account and then draw on it later. And that's an important political gesture. But, of course, you know, as those payments to the elderly come online going into the subsequent decades, it prevents people from, again, having to draw down their savings or to go into crisis mode as soon as a downturn comes, because their elderly relatives at least have a minimum provision for their livelihood. But the Social Security Act also is what gives you unemployment insurance. So again, in future when there are downturns, you don't immediately fall back on savings and charity and your family, but you have something to draw on to save you from falling immediately into penury. It also gives you disability insurance and minimal support for widows with children. So it's a kind of an all-purpose act that's supposed to protect individual Americans from the worst excesses of an economic downturn. All of those things that are the most lasting features of the New Deal really exist not to increase the power of the state per se, which is associated with more of those failed laws of the early 30s, of 1933 and so, but to use the power of the state to increase people's ability to fend for themselves. So you get much less central planning and much more sort of government support for people's ability to do their own thing.
Okay. We have a couple of callers here. We have about 5 minutes left, and we'll go next to somebody in, I guess they're both in Champaign. First, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I guess I'll be brief in the interest of time. I'm interested to hear your guest comments on the scale of the contemporary crisis vis-a-vis that of the New Deal. It seems this is more global in its reach and as compared to the earlier crisis. So your guest comments on the scale of the crisis.
I think both. Sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Both of these crises are global in scope. You know, the collapse of American lending in the late 20s is what sends Germany into depression, Western Europe into depression. And, of course, it's that depression in Western Europe that leads to the adoption of much more extreme political policies to try to get out of those crises, which, of course, is what gives you the rise of the Nazi Party and ultimately World War II. I mean, it's important to remember that the depression is global in scope. By the time Roosevelt takes office, John Maynard Keynes is writing him an open letter, which says that you are the last hope that reason will be able to resolve this crisis. If you don't, all the reasonable people around the world are looking to you to see that this problem can be solved within the framework of the current system, because Keynes can already see that there is the rise of Nazism, there is the purported successes of Stalinist Russia, and lest Western Europe fall into those traps, you know, he hopes that the New Deal will succeed. It's useful to remember that Roosevelt's time in office is almost exactly contemporaneous with Hitler's. And they're, in their way, two very different stories about how to deal with the Great Depression. So both crises really are global in scope, I think.
All right. Line number two for another caller. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I'll be brief. I was listening to a show, and I believe there was an economic historian on, and he said that Roosevelt's anti-depression policies pretty much level off at about 60% complete, I guess, in the late 30s, and that but for the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor and our entering World War II, he didn't think Roosevelt's policies would have been totally effective in drawing us from depression.
This is one of those questions that, you know, we don't really know the answer to, because the war comes along and spoils the one chance you get to see whether the New Deal would have worked. Inasmuch as this depression is a crisis more severe and unlike any other crisis in American economic history, there's really nothing else to compare it to. What you can say is that when Roosevelt takes office, unemployment is something like 25%, and that over the course of his time in office, it falls to a low of slightly below 10%, so long as you're counting those 3.5 million or so WPA employees as employed, which there's some controversy over whether you should. The key story there is that in 1937, when it looks like the economy is recovering, Roosevelt draws back on WPA spending and WPA employment and reduces relief programs, and that seems at the time to plunge the economy right back into recession. Keynes writes him another letter, says this is an error of optimism, right? So the lesson that they're supposed to have learned in 37 and 38 is that we need to double down on our relief spending, we need to run a budget deficit on purpose, that we need to pursue Keynesian policies. If you think they really did learn that lesson, then you probably have to believe that the New Deal would have been successful even without the war in terms of ending the Depression, because, of course, after that, unemployment does again begin to fall, and right through the 30s, gross domestic product is growing quite handsomely. So if you want to say, you know, would they have eliminated the Depression without the war, you can cautiously say yes. Of course, in real life, the answer is no, they did not eliminate the Depression without the war.
I suppose this is one of those, and this was on my list to ask this very question, this is one of those commonplace things that comes up again and again. People talk about the Depression and the New Deal, and they say, well, you know, as important as anything that the Roosevelt administration did, truly, if we hadn't, if the economy hadn't been stimulated by the gearing up for World War II, maybe the Depression would, at least we would have said it would have taken a lot longer for this to resolve.
I don't know about a lot longer. I mean, it's hard to say. Because you got no room to look at what would have played out. I mean, if the first time they're trying out a real life Keynesian policy is in 38, I mean, 39 is the year that the war begins. They probably would have figured out, I think you have to say, that you need to run a really much larger deficit than they were running even in 38. So charitably, we can say that perhaps a couple years into the 40s, we might have seen the Depression end, therefore, under a Keynesian kind of public works program. But, of course, that is when the Depression ends, is a couple years into the 40s, under a Keynesian-style public works program called World War II.
Mm. Well, then we're coming down to the point here. We have about a minute or so left. So I guess that is where ultimately we want to end up, is with a question like, well, what do we learn? What is it possible to learn from looking at the Depression and the New Deal, and look at what worked and didn't. And perhaps it's not, you know, the question is not so much should the government intervene, it's in what way should the government intervene?
Yeah, I think there's two lessons. I mean, number one, in terms of short-term intervention, the government probably should do fiscal stimulus. That fiscal stimulus should go to people who don't earn very much, who are much more likely to spend that money right away. This is what Keynes was saying. This is what the New Deal is supposed to learn at 38. This is supposed to be what we're supposed to know now, and I hope we'll see that go into effect. The other thing that we're supposed to learn is that look at the record of the New Deal institutions after the 1930s and the virtual absence of anything like a crisis on that scale until relatively recently. The stability that the New Deal institutions seem to have promoted, from securities regulation to labor law to deposit insurance to Social Security, is much less, we had a much less volatile economy and many fewer damaging downturns either than before or after. So in terms of planning how to fix the system going forward, we might want to keep that in mind in terms of the virtues of clever regulation. Mm.
And I think, one of the things that I think about it, and particularly because in recent years there has been so much discussion about crumbling infrastructure in the United States,
yeah,
whether we could do something that would in fact kill the two birds. I don't know if anybody's really thinking we're going to have a new WPA, but whether it would make sense to try and target some of that spending to fixing up the roads and the bridges and the schools and the public water systems and all of those things that we have not been putting money into now for decades.
Well, why not kill three birds and add in, make some super train lines so we don't have to worry so much about environmental despoliation?
Okay, I'll be happy to add that to the list. Yeah, exactly.
Which is also, again, remember, part of the New Deal. This is the era of the Civilian Conservation Corps, soil conservation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the birth of a public conservation consciousness.
Right. Well, there we will have to leave it. If you would like to read more on this subject, you can look for the book that we mentioned. It's titled The Great Depression and the New Deal, A Very Short Introduction, published by the Oxford University Press, part of their short introduction series, and there are a lot of books in this series. The author is our guest, Eric Rauschwe. He's professor of history at the University of California at Davis. And Professor Rauschwe, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 26th annual Arts and Crafts Show and Sale, November 22nd and 23rd at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sunday from 10 to 4. More information available at 367-9546. Just a quick reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, we'll be doing our monthly show on personal finance, a program that we do on a regular basis to give you an opportunity to ask questions about your own financial planning. And certainly now is a pretty serious time to be thinking about that. Our guest will be the guy who's been doing this with us for a long time, David Sinnow. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. So he'll be in the first hour. Then tomorrow morning, hour two, we'll be talking with an award-winning writer, conservationist, and photographer. His name is Tim Palmer, and we'll be talking about his book, Rivers of America. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, of course, we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. And the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll take a look at when, where, how, and why the legal system fails and what we can learn from these failings. Our guest will be Northwestern University law professor Stephen Lobet. He's the author of The Importance of Being Honest, How Lying, Secrecy, and Hypocrisy Collide with Truth in Law. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at how commodities are faring in Kansas City and Chicago. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 547. That's down 12 and a half. March, 557 and a half, down 15 and a half. December wheat trading in Chicago at 511, down 16. The March contract, 533, down 13 and a half. December corn, 369, down 9 and 3 quarters. March, 384 and 3 quarters, down 10 and a half. May, 394 and a half, down 12. July, 406 and a half, down 10 and 3 quarters. January soybeans, 870, down 27. March, 880, down 24 and a quarter. May, 885 and a half, down 27 and a half. July, 890, down 32 and a half. December meal, 262, even, down 570. December oil, 3067, down 130. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 85.75, up 155. February, 86.30. 40. That's up 125. November feeder cattle, 94.70, down 87.5. January, 90.30, up